Hi, Chief Halton here at Fire Engineering Podcasts, and we are being brought to you by Tenkata Protective Fabrics and their Made for Life podcast hosted by Stuart Perry. The Made for Life podcast unearths the work experiences of real men and women who rely on the protective clothing and equipment to get the job done. From firefighters to industrial workers to military personnel, recent episodes explore the dangers and challenges of wildland firefighting, peer counseling for first responders, and the ins and outs of turnout gear. It's the Made for Life podcast from Tenkata Fabrics. Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And thank you for listening to Fire Engineering.
Good evening, and welcome to another edition of your favorite radio show, the Larry Conley Radio Show. I, of course, as usual, am not Larry Conley, and it's mainly because the paperwork from the government has not come through, but that's a whole nother story. We'll take care of that on the next show. But in the meantime, folks, not to worry, what we have for you is our fearless leader, our host, the namesake, the courageous, the somewhat handsome, ladies and gentlemen, Captain Larry Conley. This is normally where the crowd goes wild, but due to COVID.
Yeah. It's kind of hard to hear the crowd yelling through those masks.
Through those masks, yes. Right,
yeah. As soon as the mask is over, then the crowd will go back to going wild. Well, thank you, David, for that great introduction. As usual, the check is in the mail. And thank you for joining us for another edition of the Larry Conley Radio Show. And I am Larry Conley, and that's what the that's what the bills say every month when they come to the house. So we're here again after another 7 weeks, and excited to be back as usual. And the reason we're excited to be back because by the grace of God we are back. It's always amazing to me that people we know, people in the industry and people not in the industry, maybe were here for the last show and they didn't make it to this show. So we always are thankful every time we make it back for another show. So thank God for that. The other thing is that it's June already, man. Can you believe that? Just, you know, for a minute, it was like cold as I don't know what outside. And, you know, it's June. And also it's June. It's getting closer and closer to our favorite time of the year, which is FDIC, which is going to be the first week of August in Indianapolis. And had fun last Wednesday, this past Wednesday down in Tulsa, Oklahoma for hung out with Hump Day, with the Hump Day Hankout. I don't know why I call it the Hump Day Hookup. That's another show, but my good friend Bobby Halton and some esteemed guests on the show, had a great time there at the office at Ground Zero of Clarion Events, and so we had the Hump Day Hangout and had lunch, and then toured some parts of Tulsa, downtown Tulsa, around the Greenwood area, and had a great time down there. So I like traveling. I like going to see places. I like, because this whole thing that we do a lot of times been doing on Zoom is really can be depressing, you know, because Zoom is a great way to be able to do things conveniently when it's needed, but it's nothing like the human touch, you know, and that's why I'm so wasn't too happy last year when we had to squelch all the FDIC plans and we were able to get them back this year. And with things changing so much and changing for the better as far as social distancing and all the things we had to experience during the pandemic, I think by August they're going to be things are going to be even more relaxed and not no less cautious, but definitely enough for us to all gather again in Indianapolis and exchange ideas and learn and teach and all of the above. So really looking forward to that. And if you get a chance, check out that Hump Day Hangout. We had a lot of great information on how to apply for FDIC if you want an instructor. The deadline is in a couple of weeks for submitting your proposals. So please submit your proposals, and you may get a shot. Even if you don't, keep submitting. There were a bunch of people who were on the webcast yesterday that had submitted a few times and sometimes they didn't get accepted. I know we've had a couple that didn't get accepted, but keep sending them in anyway, because I'm telling you, it's an experience like no other when you go to FDIC and learn and teach and network and really get your feel of what you need to go back and make your department better and make you better as a firefighter. It's a great conference.
And also to this year's keynote speaker will be outstanding from what I hear.
You know who that person is?
John Alston. John Alston, yeah. Another Jersey City guy.
Yeah, Jersey City. John Alston is going to be a keynote speaker, and you got somebody else too on Thursday the 5th of August. The name escapes me.
Couple outstanding. It'll
come back to you.
I believe it's two bald head African American guys.
Right.
Yeah.
North Side connection.
Oh, yeah. I think their mother had them back in the 60s.
Watch it. Careful now. Be careful. Treading on shaky ground.
But anyway, be sure to check David and I for our keynote, which will be on August the 5th. And on that Thursday, so we're looking forward to that. And we've been practicing and putting together something that we think is going to be very impactful and something you can take home with you and make an impact in your life before you leave Indianapolis. So we're that happy about sharing our message on the national stage. So be sure to get up that morning and check it out.
And let me just say, if you like The Temptations, if you like New Edition, if you like Glass Night and Pips, our keynote will be nothing like any of that, but it'll still be very exciting.
Because we can't dance. Right. Bless with that. Don't believe the hype. We can't.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to leave that alone.
but seriously, it's an honor to be able to to do it. I mean, we've been watching people from the big stage for years, and to be able to be on the big stage is a big deal for us. So two brothers from North St. Louis will be on the national stage of the biggest and baddest fire conferences in North America. So be sure to check us out, and then also be sure to check out classes out. David has a pre-conference on Tuesday of that week, and then I'll have a class on Wednesday, a classroom on Wednesday. So be sure to check us out for that. But I don't want to take too much time away from our esteemed guests. A little history about that is that a few years ago, let me take it back to even before I met our guests, is that I started in the fire service 29, almost 30 years ago now, I guess, if you count being in the academy and applying and all that. So just about 30 years ago, I decided maybe running burning buildings. That sounds like a good idea. So I applied for the St. Louis City Fire Department. And after I got on the fire department, there were a few people who, said, after I got on the fire department, hey, why don't you pursue your education? And I was like, yeah, it sounds like a good idea. But the culture was basically, why are you going to do all that? You don't have to do all that. Just, become a firefighter, become a battalion chief, become a captain, become a battalion chief. Maybe one day you'd be deputy chief and maybe one day the chief. and you don't have to have a lot of education for that. All you got to do is just, you know, learn and apply yourself, take a couple of certifications, and boom, you too could be a fire chief. So that sounds like a good idea. So, but still in all, there was this nagging thing to maybe go back and finish school. So right after I got on the fire department, I took a few classes at the community college. And that didn't last long because the classes were fun, but when you get into all that writing and all that kind of stuff like David does, it was just boring to me. So, and then you start doing things like, you know, you start having a family and start having kids and responsibilities. So it gets pushed further and further back on the back burner. So school became one of those things that I'll finish one day in the future. I'll do it one day, but not today. And so you'd be surprised how fast time passes. You know, the babies were there and they look like they're going to be babies forever. And then one day I look up and they're the same height as I am, looking me in the face and wearing the college and stuff. And I'm like,
he's graduated from college.
You know, right, yeah. And now they're in college, you know. So I'm like, this is weird, you know. So a few years ago, I'm at FDIC at a social, and I run into our guest, and we're talking, and he made the comment, and people have prompted me throughout the years, you know, hey, you know, what about, you ever thought about pursuing your education, or I see people graduating or getting degrees, and I was like, oh, okay, that's cute, but so it was always a thing that I wanted to do. I didn't necessarily want to die without some type of degree, but it's just always a back burner thing. It was intimidating to me the older I got, because school became less about brick and mortar and more about the computer. And computers, you know, they tend to intimidate me unless I'm looking on social media or buying something off Amazon. After that, I'm done. You know, I don't know what to do. So I'm at this social. And our esteemed guest said, so Larry, you know, I see you doing the glue thing and see all this great stuff about you. So, you know, where'd you get your degree? So it's crickets.
Degree?
What you mean? My degree? I wear Mitchum. I don't wear a degree.
Mm-mm,
you
know, mm-mm, you know. Mm-mm.
Degrees is 97.8 degree.
Oh, you
know?
I did the best.
No, degree. What's that? You know, so what degree of this question are you asking me? You know, so and for some reason, you know, something you heard of the proverbial straw that breaks the camel's back. That was the straw that broke the camel's back, because I talked to our guest after that, because he said, give me a call when you get back home, and we talked. And basically, by the end of the conversation, you told me, you know, Larry, it's important to get your degree going forward. It's important to get the education going forward. You can only go so far with your vision, but your vision doesn't have the accreditation and the validation of a degree. You're only gonna go so far at this point in your career. And that really hit home with me. So I think immediately after that, I started looking at different, you know, schools I thought that can help. I had a lengthy conversation with Rick Lasky, and he's with Columbia Southern, and we had almost a 2-hour conversation. So between those two conversations, between Rick Lasky and our guest, I pulled the trigger. And I've been happy that I have. Now, sometimes I'm not happy staying up at 2 in the morning drinking 9 pots of coffee trying to figure out, you know, how to do an APA format on the citation, you know. However, my life is now Tuesday, the deadline, and Saturday for discussion 3, a deadline. And that's my life. Everything else centers around that. And the good thing about being in school, when it's not brick and mortar, is you can carry school with you. So wherever I go, we travel. David knows that when we're out of town teaching, you know, I can't be at the gathering because I'm upstairs in the hotel room doing homework. But it's all going to pay off, I know. And if everything goes like it should, I should be getting the degree March of next year, 2022. So I'd be happy about that, and I'd be more happy that to be able to show my diploma to our guests. So you're probably like, well, who is this guy? Who is this guest that you speak of? And the guest that I speak of is somebody who I admire and I consider a friend, is retired Deputy U.S. Fire Administrator, Dr. Dennis O'Neill. And he's our guest today. And he was a acting fire chief in Jersey City, Jersey. He did that for 24 years, starting in 1971. And I was, what, 7 years old, something like that.
Watch it.
Let's move on.
7 years old. You know.
Who asked you?
Who asked you? You're like, I'm going to hang up on this call. But then after that, he was the superintendent for 20 years at the National Fire Academy. And Bobby, you probably know him from that if you got your EFO. From the National Fire Academy. And then after they did 5 years as the deputy U.S. Fire Administrator. And he got his PhD in 1990. And what's so significant, the reason I wanted him to come on today is because as I continue to see the importance of education, and I know the culture has always been, and it's better now, but it's still a dominant culture. And said, what are you doing all that for? You know, I think I'm the only one in my firehouse that's in school. And not that it makes me better than anyone. I'm not saying that because, I mean, you don't have to have a degree to be a great firefighter. However, it's more acceptable these days because if you want to advance, you got to have that degree. I mean, a lot of times I look at different jobs around the country. And I see all this stuff. I say, oh, I could do that. Oh, I got experience in that. Oh, I've done that 12 times over. And they get down to that one bullet point that says, you know, you got to have that degree or degree preferred or whatever. And I was like, yeah, I guess he was right. You're only going to go so far if you want to advance. But what's significant about Dr. O'Neill, what I respect so much, is that he didn't just become, you know, Dr. Dennis O'Neill. He became the doctor when it wasn't popular in our culture to have a PhD. So today we want to talk for a little bit with him about the importance of education in the fire service as firefighters, and kind of what direction. I mean, since he's went from a Jersey City firefighter to pretty much top of the food chain. I want to talk about his personal leadership and personal discipline it took to walk from there all the way to being the top dog. And then from that vantage point of seeing, where does he see the importance of education in the fire service today going forward? Because it's just like I tell my new people all the time when I get new people at the firehouse, my looking 20 years into the future is different than today you looking 20 years into the future. So you don't have the same luxury I've had of maybe having a good job, raising a family, and having some of the niceties in life going forward without some type of education to kind of continue that whole thing with the fire service. So I don't want to discount or saying that if you don't have a degree, is something wrong with you or you won't have a illustrious career. But definitely when you're a young person in the job, when you start getting around my age, you are definitely going to think different because now you got to be more cerebral than you are physical. My mind said I could still crawl down halls and jump out of windows and it, three babies in my hand. But my body be like, what do you think you're doing? So now we have to have some
options. What the heck?
So we're going to have a fun conversation, talk to Dr. O'Neill about it. And I kind of want him to kind of walk through his career, like what made you want to become a firefighter? What were some of your great moments being a Jersey City firefighter? And then, what inspired you to go for the education when it wasn't a big part of the culture? So let's all say hello to our esteemed guest, Dr. Dennis O'Neill. How you doing, Doc?
Hello.
I'm doing good, Larry. How are you doing? David, Elaine, how are you?
I'm wonderful.
Doing good. How are you, Doc?
Excited about hearing your story.
Doc, so you started out, what made you want to become a Jersey City firefighter?
It's kind of funny that I didn't want to become a Jersey City firefighter. My dad was a Jersey City firefighter. I came home from the Army, and probably 6 or 8 months later, the application came out for the fire department, and my father brought the application home, and he said, here, fill this out. And, you know, like most 20-year-olds at that time, I didn't do it. You know, I was having fun. I was done with the Army. I made it home, and I was going to be hanging out with my friends and doing all of that. And so finally, he got tired of telling me to fill it out. He filled it out, and he handed it to me, and he had signed this. And I signed it, and he mailed it in. And when I went to, in New Jersey, the state administers all of the entrance and all of the promotional exams. The city doesn't do it themselves. The city asks the state, and that the way they kind of keep it honest and keep the politics out of it. So I went with about 5 or 6 of my friends. Some of them would say the same day was for the Jersey City Police Department. And so we took the exam, and then there was a physical exam, and then there's a very cursory medical exam. But after the day was over, I was the only one that passed. So about 6 or 8 months later, I got appointed to the fire department. And when I did that day, I was afraid of heights. I wouldn't go up a stepladder. I wouldn't go up a step stool. I just wouldn't do it. But went through the training academy and wound up going on a ladder company, very, very busy ladder company in Jersey City, which kind of cured me of the fear of heights pretty quickly. You know, they did training. It was very good. So I wound up doing 15 years in a ladder company as a firefighter, then a lieutenant, and then a captain. I never, you know, I went on transfers or vacations. I might be on an engine company, but all of my assignments were ladder companies. Then I went up through the ranks after captain as battalion chief and then deputy chief. And then what happened was the chief of the department retired, and they asked me to go in as acting. And while I was in acting, they were waiting for the test. Now, the test for chief of the department is, again, it's all civil service, but the other deputy chiefs, there was 7 of them, all said, look, if you're going to take the test, we won't, if you want to be chief, we won't even sign up. And that was what was going on. And, but I was offered the job as superintendent of the National Fire Academy, and I knew that that opportunity was not going to come again. And it was one of those opportunities where you say to yourself, do I do it? Do I not do it? It was a big change. It was moving my family, all of those kinds of things. But, you know, I took the chance, which, you know, we'll talk about that a little bit later on, about what do you do when you have all of the credentials and you want to move on. And I went down as superintendent, and I loved that job as much as I love the fire department, Larry, and did that for about 20 years. And then, there were 3 deputy U.S. fire administrators during my time as superintendent. And each time I could have applied for the job, and I probably would have gotten it, but I never wanted the job. And my boss suddenly passed away in April of 2015. And they asked me to step up. And I was realizing, you know, that as you start to take measure of your life, my future in the fire and emergency services was pretty short. I didn't know when I was going to retire, but by taking the deputy job, that would allow me to hire the next superintendent and break that person in. It's called succession planning. So that's what we did. And then when I knew I was going to retire, I had announced it long before I was going to retire. And so that anybody that was interested in the job could get their application in, fill out, get their resume in order and do all that. And so I hired my replacement as deputy fire administrator, and that, and then we hired the superintendent. So it was almost perfect continuation or continuing plan of succession for the fire administration. So now the deputy fire administrator is Tanya Hoover. She was the superintendent. And then we, the new superintendent is a man named Eric Skablix, who has been the superintendent in the Oregon Fire Academy for the last 20 or 25 years. So he knows how to run a school, a fire academy. So it's, I left the organization in good shape, but it was a kind of a steady step up. And when I was always kind of the reluctant person, but I was, from getting on the job to being chief, to being superintendent, to deputy, it was all, it just fell into place. When the opportunity came, I was ready. I was prepared. I knew what to do.
That's good. Awesome. Now it makes sense to me. I was wondering why you was kind of interviewing me, because you was looking for somebody to be the next superintendent or the next.
You got it, Larry.
I goofed it up. I only had the education. I could be the top dog right now. I could be the superintendent, man.
No, but great story. I like you touched on something that's near and dear to my mom's heart, is that succession plan. And we talked about that in detail with Chief Craig Higg. So that's really critical for any job, and definitely, and we talk about the fire service, and you want the vision to continue. So kudos to you for having that particular vision. Like I said, during the time that you were, you know, getting your education, what was, number one, what was the motivation to get your education? Because with you being on busy companies, definitely, you know, it's easy to fall into the trap of like, hey, man, this is the greatest job in the world. We're making a difference in the streets, the camaraderie at the firehouse with your crew, you know, the whole thing. And then their particular culture of, you know, we're going to have fun, do the job, go home, take care of our families and all that. What sparked you to education, sticking to it, and then maybe sticking to it through maybe some of the resistance of the culture?
Well, Larry, I'm glad your mom is on, because the moms are the ones who always give us the best advice. And they always want us to hang out with the smart kids. So when I went into the ladder company, it was five truck, it was an engine company, 20 engine. And we were working a 42-hour work shift. So there was four groups, A, B, C, and D. And there were a couple of guys in the fire station, different shifts, but they were all going to school on the GI Bill, we're veterans. So I was doing what you said, you know, loved the job, very busy, learned a lot. As a matter of fact, we had a situation, we call the tour, the 2-day shifts and the 2-night shifts were one tour. And the tour was a block of time where you took assignments, like you'd be the chauffeur one tour, you would tiller one tour, you would ride one tour. You had night shift watches and day shift watches all on based on tours. And but my first 8 months in the job, I went in December, I went in the fire station. The following August, we had celebrated one complete tour without a multiple alarm fire. That's how busy it was. And but anyway, so the fellows that I was in the station with were all like, you know, we're getting, I think it was about $400 a month, tax-free, to go to school under the GI Bill. So I started hanging out with the smart kids, and we swapped shifts with one another so that we could go to school. And I finished the bachelor's degree. And at that time, you had 36 months of benefits that they would pay for your education. But at the time, right at the time I graduated, the unemployment, the economy was fluctuating from the ending of the Vietnam War. Unemployment was high. And President Carter had just given absolution, I guess, to all of the draft dodgers that ran to Canada. And he
So it was kind of a payback to the veterans. If you had an extra, if you could go to school for an extra year, they would pay for it. Mm-hmm. So you got 48 months of GI Bill. So I went for the master's degree and I finished that up. And I was teaching in the bachelor's degree program for about 5 years after that. And I had a good friend of mine that was working on his doc in education. He was a lieutenant in the New York City Fire Department, which was directly across the river from us, like 3/4 of a mile away was New York City. It was so close that I went to high school in New York City. That's how close it was. So he was working on his doc and he said, you know, why don't you give it a go? And I did. I stopped teaching and I went to finish, took me about 7 or 8 years to finish the doc at NYU. And then by that time, I'd just been promoted to deputy chief. And the folks at NYU asked me to come back to teach in the doc program in education, not fire, education. So I was teaching there for about 4 years or 5 years, 4 years. And then I got the offer to be the superintendent. So the bottom line was I'm a product of the GI Bill. You know, thank goodness for all of that. And the product of my mom's advice to hang out with the smart kids. And even though there were men in our station who, you know, like you just said, that loved the job, that, you know, scrambling in and out of burning buildings and doing all the things that we loved doing. But there was just a few of us that were going to school. So in answer to your question of what was the harassment like, pretty heavy, you know. Mm. I mean, it was just, they always pick on you in the fire station. That's that's part of what the job is all about, I guess. And it was good natured picking. But, you know, they'd say things like, you can't put out fires with books and all this other stuff, right? And then when I made lieutenant, when you get promoted in Jersey City, they put you on a different ship in a different battalion in a different company because they don't want you, you know, it's hard to be the boss of your friends. So, you know, the harassment picked up again. And at that time, I was working on my master's degree and they were zinging me. Then I made captain and it kept going, you know. And then when I made battalion chief, I was working on the doctorate and it just kind of quieted down. You know, just didn't say anything. And then nope. I made deputy chief. They were going like, chief, you know, we were only kidding, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So, right.
And then when I made chief.
We just playing.
Yeah. So then when I made chief, they were like, I told him to go to school. See? Right. So success has many fathers and failure is an orphan. So keep going to school, Larry. Mm-hmm. Sooner or later, there'll be people saying, I told him to go to school.
Right.
I see it now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was about to say, so the moral of the story is that Larry didn't really listen to his mother. but listen by default to your mother, Dr.
Okay, that's okay. Okay,
that's what I'm
okay.
Going from.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's okay. That's all right.
Good deal. The
some sow, some plant, some water.
Right. Now, so you kind of created a culture within the culture of cool kids who finished school. Now, are any of the guys that you went to school with, are they still in school? I mean, not still in school, but are they still in relevant in the fire service or got, you know, people we know or people, or, you know, how well did they do as far as their advancement?
Sure. So the fellows that I went to school with, one of them is named Jack Lynch. He since passed away. He left the Jersey City Fire Department when he was a lieutenant and went to work for the federal government. And he started the whole arson thing in the fire department with organized crime and, you know, really pushed the arson programs in the fire departments all throughout the country. Mm-hmm. Another guy named Bobby McCarthy, he retired on a disability. He went to work for the fire administration in health and safety. And he was the man that got protective equipment and did all the research on breathing apparatus and exposure forms. We were doing exposure forms in the Jersey City Fire Department in the 1970s because of Bobby McCarthy. Mm. And so He did very well. Another friend of mine who's a couple of classes, he's one class behind me, Billy Peters, wrote the classic work. It's called the Fire Apparatus Purchasing Handbook, which is still a Bible about buying fire trucks. Another guy named Butchie Cobb, who was actually my replacement in Five Truck in Jersey City when I got promoted to lieutenant. And Butchie went up through the ranks, kind of one or two classes behind me all the way up, but went to work for ISO after he retired. And after the Charleston fire, where the 9 firefighters were killed, if you look at any of those pictures, they all have ISO fire department, you know, first class fire department all over everything. ISO rated number one, ISO number one on their patches, on their fire trucks, on everything. And they had 9 firefighters killed. So at the time, it was between presidents. It was President Bush had left office. President Obama had come into office, but he had not yet appointed a U.S. fire administrator. So I was the acting fire administrator. And when that fire, tragic fire occurred, I called Butchie up and I say, Butch, you know, we got to do something about this ISO thing because they're claiming they're the best fire department in the world. And this is what happened. And Butch came down with a couple of his bosses at ISO. And after the end of that meeting, Butchie Cobb changed or worked on changing the ISO grading schedule. Now more comply with the NFPA standards. So now all of the old ISO standards are out and all the NFPA standards are in. So in that small department, another one, Mike Turpak, who came up behind me, is another published author, Larry, for fire engineering. And he's done a lot of work on strategy and tactics. And Tony Avila was in the next department over from Jersey City in North Hudson. He's written one or two books on strategy and tactics. So we're a very, very small area. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who have influenced the fire and emergency services through education. And, you know, we were right next door to New York City. Literally 3/4 of a mile away. We would fight fires together on the waterfront. We fought fires together in the subway system. We fought fires together in the Holland Tunnel between the New York City and Jersey City. But we only had about 650 people in our department. They had 13,000, you know, and we held our own in terms of influence in the nation and influence in firefighting.
Wow, sounds great. Like it. Yeah, yeah. I'm curious. When we talk about, you know, like from what I'm hearing from your experience, you know, like with the applying the GI Bill and you know that to your education and getting it. A lot of it, you know, sounds when you say it, kind of just like. You know, well, this was available, so I took advantage of it. And that I'm just wanting to ask you, looking back, like, how do you, how am I trying to say it? It sounds like somewhere in you, there's a sense of personal leadership that says applying this will somehow enhance me as a fire service professional and, you know, as a person. I guess I want to know, especially like Larry was saying, in a culture at the time that was not necessarily so bent toward getting an education for the sake of, you know, improving yourself as a fire service professional. How did your personal leadership influence your decision to pursue these degrees? And then how the degrees, you know, like further influenced your, not only your rise, but, you know, any sort of solidifying of your personal leadership or redefining of it or what happens. The relationship between those two, if you could elaborate.
Yeah, David, the relationship was really formed, I think solidified when I finished the bachelor's degree and I was working on the master's degree. had taken a course in something called psychometrics, which is about the designing and the developing of tests. And I realized that the promotional exam system in New Jersey and in New York was, that was the method by which men and women got promoted, men and women got into the job. The problem was that they didn't understand how to study for an examination. And they didn't understand what the process of taking an examination was, because they've been out of high school so long. So the bibliography for the promotions in New Jersey was about 60 textbooks. And they would ask you a question about a footnote. So I was beginning, I started helping out guys that were studying for promotion. And I it just came to me, and this friend of mine in the New York City Fire Department came to me, and we started a school to teach firefighters and fire officers how to study for examinations. And we started helping people. And that was really what was the motivation. I mean, we helped a lot of people. People that, you know, Lenny Carmichael, I know, is a friend. We helped Lenny all the way up through the ranks. And Lenny worked for us for a while. So by helping people, David, was the impetus, the passion, the whatever you want to call it, for my own self-motivation. And then we worked in New York City Fire for entrance. We had classes all over New York City, teaching men and women how to organize the material, how to study the material, how to take examinations, which is a different skill set.
Yes, it is.
Taking an exam is different than studying. And I tell people, you know, if you want to be an excellent swimmer, if you want to be an excellent bowler, if you want to be an excellent baseball player, whatever it is, those are skills. And you can read all the baseball books in the world, it's not going to make you hit a home run. You know, you got to get out and practice. So studying for an examination is reading, making sure you know the material, but it's also knowing how to take an examination. What are the tips? What are the tricks? It's nothing magical. It's just getting used to being able to do it. So the motivation, the personal leadership, I was almost thrust into it, David, by the people that I helped, because I got a lot of satisfaction out of seeing them become successes.
Mm-hmm. That's you know what? I'm glad you said that, because one of the big arguments in, and I'm sure a lot of firehouses around the country, is that, there are some people who probably adopted a lot of the same principles that you just discussed in test taking. Mm-hmm. And there's a methodology in test taking. And like you said, there's studying. And sometimes those two things don't mesh as well as they should, as far as what you need to successfully pass a test, or at least pass a test ranked high enough to be promoted. But I'm glad you said that as Dr. O'Neill, because that's a big argument in a lot of discussions in the firehouse about if someone does do well consistently on tests because they've mastered some of the principles that you talk about, it's like somehow they got the answers to the test, or somehow they must have got some inside track. And the inside track is just methodology, maybe more than the latter. And I'm not saying, there's human and there's human error. So I'm not discounting that people have and will continue to find ways to maybe cheat the system, so to speak. But I think for a person to successfully, when I see people successfully move up the ranks, I don't think it's because they always, and maybe it's different companies that give the test, but I don't think it's always based on that every testing company, they must have took the guy for drinks, and then that's why they are promoted. They've mastered the methodology. And so is there a way that you can kind of continue to expand on that a little bit, because I seem like I've been crying in the wind about it sometime in discussing it, that I don't know it as detailed as you do, but I knew it was something to the methodology of it, more than just studying, but less than I cheated on the exam. You know?
Right.
Excuse me, just a minute, doctor. I'm just so fascinated by what you just said about how to study for the test and how to take the, because it was a long time before I knew, well, I actually was a younger person, but I had taken quite a few tests. And my sister-in-law at the time told me that test taking was its own skill, that you need to also not just learn all the material, you know, that you're going to be tested on, but actually how to take a test. And I had never heard that before till she told me that. And so when you just said that now, I'm like, man, that is really key to know, because a lot of what you guys do as far as advancement or even getting on the fire department or whatever requires test taking and passing tests. So not just I need to know all of this material, but I need to know the art of test taking. So yeah. I'm just so proud you brought that up.
Let me say this right quick, Doc, before you start. I really want to piggyback on that, because my aunt, who she's speaking of, was an educator. Mm-hmm. And what,
oh, yes.
What mm-hmm. Aunt Shirley used to do mm-hmm. is she would take tests no on reason. Subjects she didn't know nothing about. Mm-hmm. And she didn't get, I mean, she said she got 100, but she mm-hmm. would score like mm-hmm. surprisingly high on right. it based on her knowing how to take tests. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm not saying that she would get 100, maybe she get 50%, but 50% on something you have no idea about mm-hmm. is a big deal. Imagine mm-hmm. if you knew what it was mm-hmm. about. So she was doing that to practice the methodology of test taking. So anyway, yes. go ahead. Mm-hmm. I'm yes. sorry. Mm-hmm.
So it's like every other cognitive and mm-hmm. psychomotor skill that you go through. If, for example, if you're going to apply to become a driver in Missouri, St. Louis, you know, you got to study the driver's manual. You got to know how far away can you park in a fire hydrant, and, you know, what's the speed limit, and all of those things you got to know. But you also have to take a driving test, and that's a different skill. You can study the driver's manual all you want,
mm-hmm.
but that's never going to help you in the driving test.
Yeah.
So what people need to understand is, well, in the fire service, let me just tell you the other piece of it. None of the textbooks are organized. They're all chapters about different topics. Mm-hmm. So there's a chapter on hydraulics. There's a chapter on ladder operations. There's a chapter on engine operations. There's a chapter on hazardous materials. Well, when you're sitting down to study, you're going from topic to topic to topic. And it's very difficult to absorb all of the information that you need. So what we would do is say, no. I want you to read this book, chapters 1 and 2. Then go to this book and read chapter 8. Then go to this book and read chapter 17. That's all hazardous materials, or it's all hydraulics. So that, and again, these people were out of school for a long time. No one ever taught them how to organize their study material. So the basic knowledge, the cognitive skill sets, they would study. They'd come back in and we'd administer examinations, one after the other, after the other. And so that they understood, we all of us have something called a cognitive style. It's kind of like your fingerprints. They're unique to all of us. We all learn different ways. And when you take a test and you get something wrong, we made them look up in the book to find out why they got it wrong. If they got it right, don't worry about it. But if you got it wrong, look it up in the book. When they looked it up in the book, they realized what they missed or how they got the question wrong. And that was a way of correcting their cognitive style. Mm-hmm. They understood how they made the mistake, whether it was a blind spot, where they didn't read the question correctly, where they misinterpreted what one of the answers were, or any of a different thing. So it's studying. It's, first of all, it's organizing the material. Mm-hmm. Studying the material, and then test taking is three parts. Mm-hmm. And when I was studying for promotional exams, I would take these exams. You know, they have books on, they call them study guides. I would do 1,000 questions a day for months, years, until I got it down. And I do it in the firehouse. I do it at home. I got so good at it that, you know, if I spend an hour, I could do 1,000 questions. Wow. And, but I got good at test taking, Larry. And that's, again, I don't care if you're playing golf, you know, you can read all the golf books you want. It's not going to help your swing. It's not going to help your putt, right? So if that's the method by which you get promoted in the fire department, understands it's three-part: organizing the study material, studying the material, and then taking an exam. Mm. And the more practice you get taking the test, it's like the more practice you get playing golf or bowling or swimming or whatever game you play is the other part of it. Knowing the rules and playing the game.
That was good. That's worth this whole discussion.
But it's also about playing, and we talk about connecting dots a lot. And it's also about, you know, applying the principle, like you do technical training.
Yes.
And Larry always says you do it so you can't get it wrong. That would be the same sort of principle, even with the testing. Mm-hmm. Sounds, mm-hmm. You
know, right.
With how to take, you know, test. And a lot of people don't necessarily get taught that it's a skill that warrants practice and the development of recognition of rather your cognitive style. You know, that's amazing.
The other thing I was thinking about as well, as far as how the personal leadership kicks in, is because very few people are going to tell you about how to just apply and take the test. You know, they may help you study the material, but not discover your own cognitive style and not discover your own. And sometimes you might have to do some investigating personally about doing stuff like that, but certainly just taking tests so you can know how to take tests. That's something you have to decide that I need to do that. If I want to go further and pass these tests that I'm having to take, then that's an individual decision you have to make. Mm-hmm. You know, your instructor, they can suggest that, but you have to take responsibility and apply personal leadership to then follow their directions. Because mm-hmm. I don't think some people may think, well, no, that you know, as long as I know the material, I don't have to practice taking tests, you know, that kind of thing. So I think it's now we're seeing all of this meshing together and all of it applies.
Yep.
Exactly. Dr. O'Neill, it just, I don't know, you know, like you hear something and it hits you again. So, I mean, you've done a good job with me on the last few years with these kind of revelations. Being a company officer and always wanting to find ways to invest in my crew, you know, we do a lot of practical stuff. So, you know, and really kind of try to really master what I consider the bread and butter stuff and a few of the things we may not see coming that I might become aware of to invest in our crew's performance on the fire ground. But also, and sometimes it becomes a back burner to me, not because that's what I want, because I just get so busy with a lot of things. But it is important to me to want to leave some kind of legacy with the crew. And I'm sure a lot of captains who maybe really care about the fire service and care about their crew want to leave some type of legacy. But one legacy I wouldn't mind leaving is leaving them some tools to be able to promote. Because if you just, you know, when I hear about company officers or leaders who, when they leave the leadership, because they were part of your crew, they're able to take some of those principles and then better themselves and become leaders themselves. And that's the best gift you can leave them. When it comes to this promotional exam, I guess legacy that I could leave. What are some of the, and I don't, you know, you don't have to get super deep with it because it's only a 5-hour show. But what I wanted is like, what are some of the things that if you were Captain O'Neill right now, on with a lot of the stuff that you know, what would be some of the things that, you know, I go to work tomorrow and I can probably, you know, show them, point them in the right direction, leave them some things that if they decided, okay, I'm ready to take some personal leadership and really, you know, work on my advancement, because I know you're not gonna be my captain forever. And one day I aspire to be captain, chief and beyond. What are some of the simple things that you would say, okay, well, here's what you need to do, or here's some books you might want to gather, here's some things you need to start practicing?
Larry, I mean, it's going to be different in every department. So I can only tell you what I did, and then you can apply it to your own department. Sure. And what the rules were. So more or less, we knew what the 60 books that we had to study from were going to be. We knew the titles, all the IFSTA manuals, Fire Chief's Handbook, Fire Protection Handbook, you know, those, Coleman's book, Clark's book, you know. Anyway, so I would sit down and maybe after dinner or after lunch or something, and if there were one or two firefighters that were interested in studying, I would sit down and help them. I'd show them how to do things. I wouldn't tell them what to do. I showed them what to do. Mm. All right. And then I would, but little by little, the people that weren't interested were like, wow, what am I doing? I'm going to sit down at the kitchen table with O'Neill too, you know, he kind of, you know, the honey and flies thing or however you want to put that. You know, I wasn't pedantic about it. I didn't say, all right, I want everybody down in the kitchen at 1 o'clock. We're going to study. No, just help this one. And then, you know, they all come. And then when there were vacancies or vacations, firefighters from other stations would want to come to our station because, you know, they knew we were studying. And then if there was an officer vacancy that I had to go on transfer, you know, then those firefighters and officers would say to me, you know, can you show us what you're doing? And I would just show them, you know. And it's not a do as I say kind of a thing, Larry, as much as a do as I do. And I think, which is one of the founding principles of leadership in any way, shape or form, you know, it's you get your work done and then what you're doing really is investing in your people. Mm-hmm. And they understand that and they appreciate that. And that'll come back to you. I mean, how many fire officers do you know that can list all of those people from one little small department of 650 people that are making a national impact? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the studying piece, the promotional piece, it's all there. So if I was a Captain O'Neill today, that's exactly what I'd be doing. Mm-hmm. Sitting down with whomever was interested.
Right.
And then I would always tell them, I'd always pick on somebody that they hated. There's always somebody in the fire bar. You know, I say, well, you know, look, Dennis O'Neill over there in 14 engine, you know, he's studying like nuts. He's right. Going crazy studying. Mm. As a matter of fact, he's going to be your boss. When he comes in the morning, he's going to tell you to do something before you have your coffee. He's right. Going to make you do something.
Right.
Mm. And, you know, and I used to use that same motivation on myself when I'd be nodding off at the books. I'd pick out somebody and say, oh, he's studying hard and he's going to beat me or tell me what to do. So
exactly. It's funny you said that because I just said that a couple of months ago when we were talking about promotion, and I was telling somebody a similar story to where I would be tired of studying. And then I think of, and I was talking about the existing people. I wasn't even talking about some of the people, but some of the existing people, I said, I cannot have that person telling me what to do. I'm lucky enough that I don't work for them now, but I've heard of them. Mm. And it's possible that they could be my captain one day. And so I don't want them by no shape or form being there telling me what to do. Mm. So what I'm going to do is I think I got another half an hour in me or hour. And I would that would keep me up a little bit longer. Just so. And unfortunately, and maybe unfortunately in some cases, I've ran into a few of those people who, if I wasn't captain, they had the power to tell me what to do. And I was able to say, I'm not doing that. They look at me like, I said, well, you know, I'm just not doing that. You know, I'm doing this. And I could, because I was the same rank, you know. So it's just, and not that, you know, people can't tell you what to do. I mean, we live a life where no matter how high you get, you always have to answer to somebody. So I'm not naive to that fact, but as much as I can control thinning that list, know, I do the best I can with thinning that list, you know, because it could be rough. But no, the good stuff, and I agree with you. I don't ever want to come down and say, hear you, we will now study whether you want to or not. I always want to make sure that I gave them something. And I've had the humble privilege of having people come to me at times and say, you know, what tidbits can you help me out with? And I'll sit down with them and tell them what I know. But I know there's so much more that I don't know, based on mastering this testing methodology. And I think we got a few people in our department who basically either subscribe to what you do or some version of what you do, because they are consistently ranking at the top of the list. And they're very good at and people think, oh, they're just smart. I think they're smart enough to master the testing process.
That's a big piece of it.
That was worth this whole show itself.
David, did you when you were in school, was some of that apply? Because it's not just the fire service. It's period, right, Dave?
Yeah. Well, when I was in school, it was there was a lot of prayer. fasting was a big deal. I didn't learn about test taking as a technique until I got to college. That was, you know, sort of fascinating to me. The other thing is, I've always kind of been like, test always sort of made sense to me. So I was kind of one of those people, like Aunt Shirley was. And then I realized what I was doing when I got to college and helped me to do it better. A lot of, you know, the technique of that was definitely applicable in class, but that plus the actual hard work of learning the material in a way that stuck and resonated with me. There was sort of a thing that was where the duality of that really helped me to excel more, because it was difficult for, let me say this, for me, expressing myself, particularly on paper or in any kind of Q&A, be that test or whatever, was always better or easy for me in stuff that I really understood sort of intimately. So as I remember, in particular history, when I was in high school, history was like a sleep aid for me. If you wanted me to take a nap, you start giving me dates and times and all of that, and the snoring would ensue. But when I got to college, I remember my first history class, and I had to take it under duress because, you know, it was a requirement for my degree. But the teacher I had, Dr. Kramer, came in, and we had this big, you know, thick book. And he just basically, we never cracked the book. He came in and sat down, and he started talking to us about all these historical figures, but he talked to us about it like he was gossiping about our family members. And it was one of those things where you learned about Ben Franklin being a drunk and a womanizer in addition to some of the other stuff he did, you know. But some of those additional anecdotes made Ben Franklin sort of come to life for me. So it was in that way easier to retain some of the information, but then not that didn't make everybody do very well on the test. It made me do well on the test because I knew how to, you know, sort of apply the test taking method to the knowledge that I was now, that I had now internalized to that degree, I guess is what I'm saying. So yeah, I did find that, and also found that practicing it made it, you know, a much easier thing to do as well. Yeah.
The fact that you had a black belt didn't intimidate any of your teachers, did it? Mm-hmm. I'm just curious.
Only when I wore it to class and stretched out before. that was a thing.
Just kidding.
The other, right quick, we start to begin to wind down a bit. Dr. O'Neill, the technique must have some validity to it because we mentioned earlier a couple of good friends, what I consider good friends of mine, and are definitely products of success in the fire service, which is Lenny Carmichael and John Austin. Mm-hmm. And was John Austin also kind of a product of the methodologies and stuff you talk about?
Mm-hmm. John's affliction was that he went to a Jesuit high school in Jersey City called St. Peter's. And so when you go to a Jesuit high school or a Jesuit college, you become a philosopher. So John had to philosophize a lot, and he missed an opportunity or two, but he got his way right up to the deputy chief in Jersey City. But great guy. We worked together. I was his captain. I mean,
Yeah, and that must be a big deal for him to. Well, it kind of, once again, it talks about what I just got you talking about. He worked with you in that capacity. Then your belief and personal leadership led you to the positions you had, and now the people who were part of your system are also he's the, you know, the top dog and the chief in
Haven.
In New Haven, Connecticut. So that's what I'm talking about when you not only just rise yourself, but you leave legacies of other people rising in their own right.
You know? Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, Doc, how intentional is that for, like, say, where you identify John Austin and say, well, I'm going to be intentional about, you know, instilling that kind of personal leadership in that person? Or is it a thing where you just do it and whatever that is that's in John Austin that makes him, you know, a great leader and a great individual gravitates toward that thing in you? I mean, is it more of that, or is it more a combination?
I think it's a combination, David. I don't know that there's any magic formula, but I can point to people that attended the National Fire Academy that I did the same thing with over the years. So you may know Dr. Kwame Cooper. Mm-hmm. Now, you always get these personal connections. I went to high school in a section in New York City called Harlem, and it was a pretty tough neighborhood in those days. Kwame Cooper grew up in Harlem, so he came to the National Fire Academy. He was either a lieutenant or a captain in LA City. And I think he might have had an associate's degree. So I visited a class, and I'm just talking to the students, and I picked up on his accent. I said, "You're not from California. Where are you from, New York?" And he goes, yeah. And then I said, "Come on, you know," afterwards we talked. And I said, "What are you doing about school?" And, you know, blah, 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 giving me some dance, you know, why he, and I said, "Come on, let's go, let's get into school." So he went in, he got his bachelor's degree, he got his master's degree. And a month or so ago, he called me up and he finished his doctorate. And I pushed him all the way through kicking and screaming. But another guy was a lieutenant down in Atlanta. And I was at a conference, and he was like the lieutenant in charge of making sure that the conference went okay. You know, they detailed him to do this off-duty job. And so I started to talk to him. I said, "You know, what are you doing?" I found out he was a Marine, and, you know, there's a connection there. And And I said, what are you doing about school? Same story. Well, yeah, I'll give you the. And so I said, come on, let's go. Let's sign up for school. And pushed him. He got his associates. He got his bachelor's degree. He got his master's degree. He's one of the very few people that has been a metropolitan. He's been the fire chief of two metropolitan fire departments, Atlanta and now Austin. His name is Joel Baker. I don't know if you know Joel. And Dr. Byron Kennedy, who's the number two guy in Atlanta. I mean, you just, you know, I met these people, and it's just probably 20 or 30 or 50 others that over the years that I kind of pushed through. And like, you know, like our conversation with you, Larry, you know, you push people. And I know I'm bullying them to some extent. I know that. And that's how you can use your, well, you know,
no, I'm just kidding.
What you're doing is you have an opportunity mm-hmm. to influence people
mm-hmm.
because you have a certain level of responsibility. Mm-hmm. You know, if the superintendent of the National Fire Academy pulls you aside and says, what are you doing about school? That's not like the lieutenant in mm-hmm. St. Louis mm-hmm. asking mm-hmm. you, what are you doing about
mm-hmm.
school?
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of push people. And so, yeah, in answer to your question, David, it's probably some combination of interpersonal connections somehow, or somebody that you meet, or somebody says something or does something that mm-hmm. You're like, wow, you know, they have a lot of talent. Let me find out what they're doing. And what is a woman that you may have run across, Yvonne Fehu. She's down in Florida. She's very influential in fire prevention field. And she came to a class at the National Fire Academy. And it was a pilot class. They were testing it on a regular class to see how well the course would go. And she turned that thing around 180. And really, and so I got her aside and, you know, got her connected into a couple of different groups. So you just do that for people. And because it was good to you. I mean, the job was good to you. The profession was good to you. Mm-hmm. And you want to bring up people that are going to contribute yeah. just the same, you know, that'll do well. And you can change the future.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of stories that I like to tell. But one of them is about a guy named Joey Barrow. And Joey Barrow was the youngest of about six kids. His brothers and sisters had all graduated. His dad wasn't in the picture. And his mother was raising him, but she was always worried that he wouldn't turn out to be somebody or something, you know. So she made him take violin lessons. And he went to a city school, kind of like St. Louis. He was in school in Detroit. And of course, you're taking violin lessons, and all the kids called him a sissy, calling him names and picking on him and everything, like they do, like kids are cool. And so one day, these kids started picking on him, and he took his violin case and he whacked one of the kids over the head with the violin case and knocked him down. Well, all of the other kids that were there now started to pummel Joey Barrow, started to beat him up and everything. And there's this big kid in the class. His name is Thurston McKinney. I don't know if you ever heard of Thurston McKinney, but Thurston McKinney reached down into the crowd and he pulled Joey Barrow out and he said, I'm going to teach you how to box. And he said, come on. So he took him down to the gym and they had to get a gym locker. And the only money that Joey had was the money that his mother gave him for the violin lesson that day. So he gave the man the money for a locker, and Thurston took Joey into the ring and they started to spar, practice boxing. And in a few minutes, Joey Barrow hit Thurston McKinney in the chest so hard that he knocked him to the mat. Now, Thurston McKinney was no ordinary kid. At the time, Thurston McKinney was the Golden Gloves champion of Detroit, Michigan.
Wow.
He was a high school Golden Gloves champion. So Joey started to back up because he was afraid of what Thurston was going to do when he get back up on his feet. And so Joey said, Thurston told Joey, you put that violin away. I'm going to teach you how to box. And he did. And within 4 years of graduating high school, Joey Barrow was a heavyweight champion of the world.
Wow.
And he was worried when he started boxing professionally, he was worried that his mother would find out that he was boxing, that he stopped taking violin lessons. Mm. So he changed his name so his mother wouldn't find out. You know, she read the sports papers. Mm. And the world knew for years before his mother ever did that Joey Barrow changed his name to Joe Lewis.
Mm-mm.
And that's a true story.
Wow.
So wow. You never know when you invest in somebody what the outcome is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been my belief mm-hmm. all along. You know, I never knew any of these fellas are going to be what they turned out to be, but they just had something, and it's important to invest in those people.
One of the things I'm listening to, too, and hearing is that some of the stuff that you're teaching them under the umbrella of how to take tests and all these kinds of things, but there's still things that you can apply to your life too, not just trying to get a degree, but some things take discipline, a certain level of discipline, a certain level of studying. And one thing you said that stood out for me is that we have all our own way of learning too. So I can't maybe learn like you, but now I do know I have my own way and learn how to apply that. So I'm just saying too, it's not just for academics. It's things that you can learn how to build your character, how to, you know, become a better person and apply those same principles that and then pass on the, you know, enhance their personal leadership skills as well. So this is really good. I got two pages of notes.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm. This is good.
Now, and this is interesting, a little known fact about Larry is that he has passed by several violins. I tried to play, he used to play the trombone.
All of you all, don't start talking. All of you all had to take some kind of horn lessons, okay? I'm just saying.
Yeah, we did. The trombone, the trumpet, for both of them. I say that I was getting ready to tease you earlier. It's like, good. What is it about you that makes people want to say, you know what? I just had a conversation with Dennis O'Neill. Now I'm gonna go be great. What kind of psycho-cerebral bullying is
hypnosis and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, really, I don't know what it was like.
Yep. All under his spell.
Yeah, like I said, I've been talking to people for years. I'll go back to when I get good and ready. You're not the boss of me. You know, so Neil said, next thing I know, you know, I'm paying
that tuition bill.
Yeah, right. I'm like, I don't know, you get some kind of kickback from people's education or what, you know. But seriously, I appreciate being on that list because it sounds like it's a great list of people who have achieved. And if the fruits of the labor that I've seen and people that you've influenced, if I can, it does two things. It makes me happy because I see that the sky's the limit. And it's also intimidating because I don't want to be the guy on the list. It was like, you know, I tried to help Larry County. That poor guy, you know, he never did finish, you know.
You just gave me a bet. If he start, you know, tripping,
mm-hmm.
I got the backup.
Well, I know that sometimes I'll be in the middle of the night, I can barely keep my eyes open, but I got the deadline, I'm typing, I didn't hit a writer's block of some sort, and I might post something to try to keep me entertained while I'm waiting for my coffee to brew. and I'll say something like, yeah, man, this midnight oil is, you know, getting old or something like that. And Dr. O'Neill always chimed through like, hey, keep churning away, guys. But
I know you probably want to inbox and say something else. Like, they ain't politically correct on social media.
No. Stop trying to stay professional.
Yeah. The doctor is in, you know.
These are some good principles for real, though.
But no. Let's start wrapping it up because I want to respect the doctor's time and all. And I just want to say, you know, I really appreciate you coming on to talk to us, and it's been, you know, really reawakening some of the stuff that we knew, and adding more context to everything when it comes to achievement and promotion. And one last thing I want to ask you about. You've seen things from the national perspective going forward as far as the U.S. Fire Service, and you got a lot of people coming on the job every day. I know our department is turning into a relatively young fire service because a lot of old guys and gals are retiring and moving on. As a person who's seen it from 300, 1,000 feet or whatever, and you see the trajectory of things, what would you be your advice for someone in the fire service now, young in the fire service, coming on the fire service, and going forward based on your vantage point of what you've seen from your position?
A couple of things. One is if they're happy being firefighter and they like scrambling in and out of burning buildings, that's fine. It's a great job and we all love it. Mm-hmm. But as you pointed out, Larry, when you become a certain age, the mind is willing, but the flesh is weak. Mm-hmm. You know, you just, you can't keep doing that. And the second question is something else that you mentioned is, do you want that person telling you what to do when you go to work every day? So you have to really decide, do you want to take on a leadership role? And in my view, that leadership role is one of responsibility. You don't have any perks, you don't have any privileges, you have a lot of responsibility and then what it is. But if you decide you're going to do that, if you decide you're going to put down the tools and pick up the flashlight, you are going to have the opportunity to change the things in the job that you don't like, the things in the job that you know can be done better or in a different way, or give other people opportunities, or whatever it is you think is important, because you can't do it whining at the kitchen table. You've got to step up. And as Frank Vespucio says, step up and lead. You know, you've got, as you think with your glue, get up, lead. Those are the kinds of men and women that we're looking forward to for the next generation. And you can do it. We are not brain surgeons. None of us are. Okay. The only thing that an education gave us, we all have V6 engines. The only thing that education gives us is a bigger gas tank. you can go a lot farther, but it's still the same engine. Right. And so if I was starting the job tomorrow, and I wish I was, that would be the advice I'd give people. Love the job, but decide if you're going to take on a leadership role and then go for it.
Okay. It makes a lot of sense because you are right. There are people who sit around the kitchen table and that's it. I remember years ago, I was sitting around the kitchen table and I didn't have a lot of time on the job. I knew enough to know that we were discussing like what people were learning coming out of the academy, and they were like, it wasn't that the academy wasn't doing a good job, but just for some reason, there was, I felt like there was a missing link in personal leadership because they knew all the technical stuff really well, but they kind of sucked as team members, you know, not all of them, but just enough to get your attention. And I said, boy, this something needs to be done. Somebody needs to do something. And I volunteered for the first recruit class that I taught and helped teach. And from there, it over almost a 20-year span, PRN, I'll go down and teach a recruit class, which became known as Uncle Larry's Playhouse, and interjecting some of the principles that we teach in GLUE today. So GLUE kind of evolved from that. And whenever people ask the history of it, I always say GLUE 1.0, different than maybe GLUE 6.0 today, was born out of the trying to fill in that missing link in personal leadership, you know. And make sure that we don't raise fools with tools, and that's what I was afraid of, you know. Mm. You know, we had a lot of people great with tools, but their mentality scared me. When we kind of bridged that gap between making sure we didn't have fools with tools, I think it makes for a better fire service, and that became hopefully my. Part of my legacy and what I left. And I think if everybody decide, like you said, maybe discuss it at the kitchen table, but mobilize with a plan of how they can help what they're complaining about, then the fire service continues to get better. And then from that, you know, we kind of walked the dog up through the national stage in Africa and Alaska. So we've been worldwide, and now to, you know, to go do the keynote is all basically from a conversation at the kitchen table about 20 years ago. So it's you never know, you know. And so I can appreciate, you know, your response to that, because that's exactly, I feel like, the track that we took, you know, getting to this point. I appreciate that. David, any closing words as we go around and close this thing down?
No, I mean, I just, a lot has been validated for me in addition to learning some new things. Also good to know I got somebody to call if you start slacking on the school. So it's important to have that ace in the hole. But no, seriously, you know, just a lot of good information. I hope people are able to, you know, sort of take away just the principle of, you know, like you can read all the books you want on golf, but eventually you're going to have to take some swings and, you know, work on that particular technique, you know, and that's sort of a, it's something I knew, but it's a, you know, like a relearning of that for me, a re-energizing of that principle in my life. So I appreciate you for that, Doc. And I enjoy the conversation a great deal, and hoping that we have, you know, many more. So thanks for your time.
Elaine?
Well, first of all, I want to say I think we need to bring him back for a part two. But a couple of things. One of the things when you mentioned about succession planning, I think that's really key. You know, my son said, you know, that's big for me. But it just dawned on me when you were wrapping up that not only should a leader have a succession plan, but if you're going to be a personal leader, like your personal leadership, then you also need to have a succession plan for what you're going to do when you can't climb those ladders or you can't do all of that other stuff. So now for the last part of your life, when you're getting close to your retirement years, what else are you going to be prepared for? And so that sounds like some type of a succession plan too. You know, what's going to come next in your life? Because, you know, you don't want to just necessarily go somewhere and just sit down, but you can still be productive, but you may not be able to, you know, go in and crawl in whatever all those firefighters do in the flames and stuff, especially for firefighters, but anybody. So I thought that was really an epiphany for me. And the other thing was that you said was, we all have a unique cognitive style, our own learning style. So I think that's one thing people need to really remember and need to really try to see what that is, so you'll not compare yourself to somebody else because they seem to grasp things a certain way or whatever. You find your style, you do you, you'll be just as, you get a PhD too, your way. So I mean, I got a bunch of nuggets, but I can't, you know, go another hour, but I could. but also, I just like the way everything tied into you also having to exercise some personal leadership, period. Even though you get sitting them down and, saying what you say to people, they have to finally, in essence, make up their own mind to follow what you say and apply it to themselves. So, and also, I just want to say, you did a really good job of talking about yourself. Excuse me. I'm sorry. I'm teasing.
Great stuff.
I enjoyed this one. This was fantastic.
Yeah, and fantastic. I like that whole thing. I think they had to preach, if you say, have any personal succession plan.
You know, you think I didn't write that? You're right. Yeah, I put my name bad. I'll let you use it if you want to.
Right.
To a small fee. Right. You know.
Dr. O'Neill, you got any closing before I wrap it up?
Well, Larry, I just listened to your mom, and I think she will be the great keynote at your graduation party. I plan to be there, and I just wanted to know where you're going to go to start your master's degree.
Yeah, I'm still trying to decide that what I'm going to do. I don't know if I'm going to stick with Columbia Southern or go somewhere that is, you know, I mean, better. I need to weigh the variables and talk to people like you and some other
don't
people.
Don't wait. Keep going.
No, I'm going to keep going. I'm just saying, just to know where to go, you know.
The most dangerous thing is to say, I'm going to take a year off. Mm-hmm. And no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I messed up. I did that and it turned into 30 years. So. I don't have another 30 years. On 147 for his graduation.
Start your master's degree in April.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
most definitely. There you go. Mm-hmm.
All right, Larry. Thank you so much.
There you go. Thank you.
Yeah.
This was
What are you doing now? What are you doing now that you're retired?
Doing mostly consulting. I have some work with FirstNet. I'm doing some work with them. Doing some work with some fire departments, and then I'm doing some public speaking. I'm going next week down to Louisiana Fire Chiefs. I'm speaking at another conference, speaking at FRI. There's a couple of them on the calendar. So public speaking and consulting is mostly what I've been doing.
Will we see you at FDIC?
Hope so. I'm looking forward to it.
Good deal. Mm-hmm. And then if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Email is donieal@comcast.net. And my cell is 717-253-2320. And Larry, you feel free to give them my contact information. I know you have it as well. Mm-hmm. So if you feel free, you can spread that around any way you want.
Okay. No problem. And I'll be in touch more because there's a kind of, I'm just celebrated 29 years. So moving forward, you know, and I got more days behind me being the captain in St. Louis, but I'm excited by what the future may hold.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And you know,
when's the BC test coming up? When's the BC test coming up?
Well, that's some political talk that probably needs to happen. Off.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Call that number he gave you.
Right. I got some opinions, but I'll keep it to myself. I need to keep my job. But whether it's here or somewhere else, you know, that's why I say getting a degree is more personal in getting the degree than anything else. Mm-hmm. However, you know, whatever opportunity that may come from having it is going to be a blessing. And so I'm not necessarily chasing a degree to chase a position or opportunity more than it's a personal thing. And both my sons are in college now too. So it's kind of fun to go back and forth with them. You know, we are college students, you know, so we all got our backpacks and stuff like that. So it's kind of cool.
I think somebody's going to be on your head though. You know, just something I detected.
I'm on his head. I'm on the social media. Every once in a while, I send him a little note.
Every once in a while, I get a little kick in the, kick in the bunkers about the good doctor. But
let's go. Keep going.
I'll keep going. And you're right. I'm going to keep the masters because I'm the kind of person that, is it like fighting fire? Sometimes I hate wintertime firefighting. It's 4 degrees outside and we got
the water going down.
I hate
But sometimes they'll bring like maybe a rehab bus out with warm, mm-hmm. and they'll say, you know, everybody go on the bus and rehab and then come back out. I won't go in as much as I hate being out in the cold. And the reason I won't go in, because I know when I go in, I may not go back out. I might get tired. I'm not going back out there. It's cold out there. You know, so I'll stay out and almost freeze to death. So my point is, that same mentality is the same with this school. I can't quit. And then I'll go back because I'll probably never go back. But
now I have some help. David and your mom are both now on you, like me.
Right. You got some agents.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
The O'Neill agents. Mm-hmm. Dennis and the O'Neills.
do that backup dancing, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, just to wrap it up, I want to thank everybody for listening to this edition of the program. Very informative, as I predicted it would be. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I always considered Dr. O'Neill a good friend, even greater friend, for caring enough. And I mean, and we know each other, but didn't know each other well enough for him to, you know, say, hey, what are you doing? Almost like businesses if you were, sir. but like you said, the superintendent of National Fire Academy and the deputy U.S. Fire Administrator mm-hmm. asked you that type mm-hmm. of question, you feel compelled to be accountable mm-hmm. some kind of way, you know. So I just want to thank you for not because of your position, but just because of your great balance of mm-hmm. your humble spirit and that gentle nudge, that nudge enough to let you know I mean business. Mm-hmm. I'm asking you this question to motivate me and mobilize me to go ahead and finish this degree. So I appreciate mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. And also I've got some great takeaways, pretty much the same along the same lines of what Miss Elaine was talking about when it comes to you know, the art of test taking, personal succession planning, mm-hmm. and so forth. Also glad to be called friends, people like Lenny Cormichael and John Austin.
Oh my goodness.
And they were big brothers to me when I first started coming to FDIC.
They're old.
My first class, mm-hmm. we were kind of story out, mm-hmm. like, you know, like, what's this all about? And mm-hmm. is it so big? And I heard about FDIC, but I never experienced it. And when I got there, they was like, oh, so who are you? And I was like, yeah. Mm-hmm. The guy, my first time instructing, you know, they were like, well, come on with us. And, you know, here's the great place to eat, and here's a great place to hang out, and here's the place where we can talk, brother talk, and all, you know, so it was a really great experience. So to have that kind of connection all the way back to you is even more, mm-hmm. you know, more makes it more real and make them know I'm in the right circle of great. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate mm-hmm. that from those guys. But we're going to, I don't know if we have another show. This is June. So I don't know if we have another show. For FDIC, and I have to check and see, but mm-hmm. we're going to do a live show from FDIC, mm-hmm. And if all goes right, we might have Deputy Chief Tiffany Wesley interviewing us, David.
Mm-hmm. Because
we don't have anything else planned. But usually what Dave and I do is live from FDIC, we interview one of the keynote speakers.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that something? Mm-hmm. So now
The
keynote speakers will be being interviewed. Yes. Yay.
Yeah, see, that's how that works.
My science.
Yeah. Your science.
I'm just saying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You did good, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did the best I could. Stuff, yeah. Watch it. Yeah. That's okay. Okay, wrap it up.
Beatings. You know. No. But seriously, so we're looking forward to that experience. So if we don't have another one before then, we'll see you live from FDIC for that show. And then we got some great guests coming up as we start going toward the cold weather. So I'm looking forward to those guests as well. But Doc, thanks for taking the time to hang out.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Elaine, Larry,
oh,
David.
Gosh, yes.
And then as we get closer to March 2022, I'll let you know where we're in the
graduation is going to take place.
I'll be there.
We want you to be there. Mm-hmm. So I can give you that.
Since it's your fault anyway.
Shaking, I know that's right.
Handshake and hug with my cap and gown on, you know. Mm-hmm. I've been imagining that moment. So you'd be wondering if I want to hug when I finish. And I'm not a hugger, so I must be.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's all right, though.
Yeah, our mother didn't hug us when we were.
No.
But that's for a Dr. Phil show. We're not going to talk about that here.
you're still in school working on your degree, though, right?
Right, yeah.
Uh-huh, so I need to hug you. Just right. Keep behind. Right. When he started talking to you, it sounded familiar, didn't it?
Right, yeah, sure did.
See, Dr. Dennis is like, well, when are you going to do your master's?
Yeah.
How that sound? It sounded familiar, didn't it?
Sounded real
familiar. Okay, never mind. Go ahead.
Check us out on the web, on Facebook, and check us out at www.glunationldc.com and see where Larry and David are. In the world, and as the world opens back up, we'll be more back on the road and looking forward to that. So I don't have anything else. So we'll see you guys in 7 weeks.
All right. Thank you again, doctor.
Bye-bye.
Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Thank you.